So life was about responsibility. And the earth was the mother. And at some point in the evolution of the human beings, another perception of reality appeared. And this perception of reality, it took the spirit away from the animals and all of the other things, and it started changing spirit into human form, the gods and the goddesses. So at some point in the evolution, see, it started to take the way the people prayed. But it has to do with iron and bronze and all these things being starting to become mind. So it's like it kind of evolved in this kind of a way. It's like, see, in a way, religion emerged, but it was like a mining tool for the technologic reality that was manifesting itself through industrialization. But it became almost like a tool, see, because you got to go to the center of where the human being is, because all human beings want to know where we come from and where we're going, what's our purpose. So you've got to go there if you're going to mess with them. You have to go there to the very beginnings. The beginnings and the heart of the spiritual realities. So the God thing evolved, the religious thing, that changed the creation story from being a creation story to where there was a new story. And this new story was that there was a male dominator God removed from the earth who owned everything because he made it. So he owned it. All right. Now, at this point in our common collective genetic ancestral memory, every one of our relations back in that time rejected this because life worked for them. Because the earth was the mother and the sky was the father. It's like the great spirit, spirits, everything, it worked for them. They maintained a balance. They knew who they were. They knew what their purpose was. They knew their relationship to power. They knew everything about their lives. So it worked for them. But they were forced to accept this other perceptional reality through violence and terror and aggression. Same thing happened to the Indians here. By the descendants of the tribes of Europe, happened to the tribes of Europe and their descendants. That's why they behaved the way they did when they got here. And this is where I think sexism comes from. I think it comes from our relationship to the earth. See, I think sexism was one of the mining tools, because when you're going to convince all of the human beings in whatever tribes that they're in, as you come into contact with them, you had to turn them against the earth to promote this male god thing. To alter the perceptional reality. So this is where sexism came. It came as a way because, see, as long as the people considered themselves to be the children of the earth and a part of the earth, they would not plunder the earth. They would not aid and abet or accept the plundering of the earth because the earth is their mother. See, so that's why sexism came in as a way, because in order to attack the earth amongst the human beings they came into contact with, they had to attack their perceptional reality about the woman in relationship to the earth and life. So sexism, so it was like a mining tool to help turn us against the earth and make the earth available for plunder.
I'm trying to outline the conditions for entering into the Ecozoic era. That, I think, is what is necessary. In a sense, I think of it as a new mythos, the new myth, because we have to be entranced with something, because right now we are entranced with the technological order. You can only counter an entrancement with a counter-entrancement. We've got to be actually entranced. Otherwise, we will not have the energy, the psychic energy. We will not be able to endure the pains of transformation, although once we are sufficiently clear on where we are headed and the urgency of it and the adventure of it, we can get on with it and accept and ignore almost the difficulties and the pains and be able to endure it, because we are involved in a great work and in creating a great work. The incidentals fall away. Even the sense of difficulty, we can accept much of the great sorrow that will necessarily go through, and we must certainly train our next generation how to engage in a vast creative effort, not simply try to endure and live amid the ruined infrastructures of the industrial world and amid the ruins of the natural world themselves, itself, which is already predetermined. There's no way in which they can escape that. But they have to engage in a fantastic creative vision and a great creative task. It is the task of the planet. It's the task of the universe, as it were.
Now the stone rolled over to close the wound, the earth long seeded in grief and blood, restored in love, renewed in light, the thief to the left and the thief to the right, with blood run thin, with day become night, to you who once were.
All of us go through that. We are born with, you might say, a 360-degree personality, and then as we grow, people start telling us, oh, I don't like that part, or it's too noisy, or it's not civilized, or oh, be nice to your sister, or it's not nice to try and eat your brother, or things like that. And so you begin to put all these things in a bag and just become, you start to take parts of yourself and put it away, and you start to become just much less than you can be. And it's very much like the landscape that's around us, that slowly plants and animals and things begin to be lost from that. And so the ecosystem itself becomes less vibrant, less whole, less wild, more domesticated, less frightening to human beings. You might say the grizzly bear in us, the wolf in us, those things have all been taken away, and what's left are plantain and dandelion, and that's fine as far as it goes. But so what happens is in a way, the ecological reclamation of the world begins with us reclaiming the parts of ourself that have been lost. And the more whole we get, the more our wildness comes back, the more we can deal and understand why wolf and grizzly bear, snake, poison ivy are important. Joan Halifax has this great thing, she said once. She said, as soon as snake and rattlesnake and poison ivy and grizzly bear disappear, that ecosystem begins to become damaged. Because when then human beings walk into it, we're no longer careful. Those things generate a attentiveness of mind in us. And so, in a way, that's happened with us, too. We've lost these parts, and we don't really need to see or look in a way. There's not that vitality.
One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough. In a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly, arranging her dark skirts, her pockets full of lichens and seeds. I slipped as never before, a stone on the riverbed. Nothing between me and the white fire of the stars but my thoughts, and they floated like as moths among the branches of the perfect trees. All night I heard the small kingdoms breathing around me, the insects and the birds who do their work in the darkness. All night I rose and fell, as if in water, grappling with a luminous doom. By morning, I'd vanished at least a dozen times into something better.
Story is waiting to be written and drummed. It goes something like this. Once upon a time, in a time before time, in the timeless now, in approaching a timeless future, humans awakened to feel in the cells of their bodies that within those cells were the very elements of the earth. Feeling the soil, the rivers, the breeze, and the sunlight in their veins, they realized that they had been dreaming. In fact, for after several million years, they had been dreaming a very bad dream. You could even call it a nightmare. They dreamed that they were separate from the earth, superior to it, commanding and dominating. Soil, rivers, breeze, and sunlight were things to be managed and allocated, not to steal and savor. As they awakened, they tasted, smelled, looked upon, listened to, and bathed in the soil until they felt themselves at one with it, until their skin, eyes, hands, and tongue became the soil itself. They remembered that the word human comes from the Latin word humus, or earth. No longer did they experience their bodies as comprised of billions of cells, but rather as a collection of billions of grains of soil. And because they felt, smelled, tasted, sounded, and looked like the earth, they felt in every grain of soil, every cell of the body, their union with every living thing on the earth. They did not remain walking upright only, but sometimes crawled on their bellies on the earth, sometimes sat in a tree, sometimes breathed in rivers, sometimes held conversations with deer, and all the while delighted in every breath of air that passed in and out of their lungs.
There is a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what things you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die. And you suffer, and you get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding, but you don't ever let go of the thread.
There is a 2-million-year-old man no one knows. They cut into his rivers. They peeled wide pieces of his hide from his legs. They left scorch marks on his buttocks. He did not cry out. No matter what they did, he did not cry out. He held firm. Now he raises his stabbed hands and whispers that we can heal him yet. We begin the bandages, the rolls of gauze, the gut, the needle, the grafts, we slowly, carefully turn his body face up. And under him, his lifelong lover, the old woman, is perfect and unmarked. He has laid upon his 2-million-year-old woman all this time, protecting her with his old back, his old scarred back. And the soil beneath her is fertile and black with her tears.
You, darkness, that I come from. I love you more than all the fires that fence in the world. For the fires make a circle of light for everyone, and then no one outside learns of you. But the darkness pulls in everything. Shapes and fire, animals, and myself. How easily it gathers them, powers and people. And it is possible a great energy is moving near me. I have faith in nights.
If you don't know
the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are,
a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong god home,
we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind,
a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors
of childhood, storming out to play through the broken dike.
And as elephants parade, holding each elephant's tail,
but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel,
and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs,
but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice.
There's something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk.
Though we could fool each other, we should consider lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep.
The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. Thank you.
outside us. Learn only a few steps. The do you work in 4/4 time? The what do you expect walls? He hasn't noticed yet the woman standing away from the lamp. The one with black eyes who knows the rumba and strange steps and jumpy rhythms from the mountains in Bulgaria. If they dance together, something unexpected will happen. If they don't, the next world will be a lot like this one.
Joy is that extraordinary happiness that is independent of what happens to us. The root of joy is gratefulness. We tend to misunderstand the link between joy and gratefulness. We notice that joyful people are grateful and suppose that they are grateful for their joy. But the reverse is true. Their joy springs from gratefulness. If one has all the good luck in the world, but takes it for granted, it will not give one joy. Yet even bad luck will give joy to those who manage to be grateful for it. It is not joy that makes us grateful. It is gratitude that makes us joyful.
It is not joy that makes us grateful. It is gratitude that makes us joyful.
Defeat. My defeat. My solitude and my aloofness. You are dearer to me than a thousand triumphs, and sweeter to my heart than all world glory. Defeat, my defeat, my self-knowledge, and my defiance. Through you I know that I am yet young and swift of foot, and not to be trapped by withering laurels. And in you, I have found aloneness and the joy of being shunned and scorned. Defeat, my defeat, my shining sword and shield. In your eyes, I have read that to be enthroned is to be enslaved, and to be understood is to be leveled down. And to be grasped is to but reach one's fullness, and like a ripe fruit to fall and be consumed. Defeat, my defeat, my bold companion, you shall hear my songs and my cries and my silences, and none but you shall speak to me of the beating of wings and urgings of seas and of mountains that burn in the night, and you alone shall climb my steep and rocky soul. Defeat, my defeat, my deathless courage, you and I shall laugh together with the storm, and together we shall dig graves for all that die in us, and we shall stand in the sun with a will and we shall be dangerous. There's a country to cross, you will find, in the corner of your eye, in the quick slip of your foot, air far down, a snap that might have caught. And maybe, for you, for me, a high passing voice that finds its way by being afraid. That country is there for us, carried as it is crossed. What you fear will not go away. It will take you into yourself and bless you and keep you. That's the world, and we all live there. Death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn. When death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut. When death comes like the measles pox. When death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades. I want to step through the door full of curiosity and wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, toward silence. And each body a lion of courage, and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world.
native peoples of this continent constantly talk about the instructions that they get from the trees, they get it from the stars, they get it from the wind, the streams and the flowers, the birds and so forth. They give them instructions. That's why they, thinking about the future, people went to and various techniques of reading the stars, reading the weather and so forth. It's enormously important that, we learn to get our instructions. One community. There is no such thing as a human society or even possibly a human culture. We tend to think of the human in a certain isolation with our psychology and our sociology and our economics sometimes, but there's only one community. There's only one economy. There's only one health system. There's the planetary health. It will be total or it will not be. Only one moral order, one religious dimension. There's only one. It's an integral reality.
Begin to disappear from an ecosystem, what happens is you get what's called a trophic cascade. That means the ecosystem begins to kind of collapse from a high degree of complexity to a lower level of complexity. And that makes it less able to respond to ecosystem challenges. And when that starts happening a lot of places around the globe, what you start getting is these really wild gyrations in environmental functioning. I mean, you know, the stuff we see in the news, look, by the time the newspapers begin to report something, you got to realize the trouble's been going on a long time, and it's a lot deeper than they're ever going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the focus tends to be on global warming or ozone depletion or a few things like that. The factors involved in ecosystem disruption, there's several hundred of them, all of them equally as serious as global warming. One of them is the damage to plant species. Just say from monocropping in agriculture, you know, most people actually think farming is what's happening in the United States. Well, it's not really. It's like hydroponics, only they're not using water as the medium, they're using earth as the medium. It's like humus ponics or something, and the soil is just a thing to hold the root system. It's not alive anymore. It's not a living thing like humus normally would be. And so we see those plants and we're under some assumption that there's still living things there, but monocropping reduces plant diversity in ecosystems, and what you start to get is this degradation of complexity of response to environmental perturbations in the ecosystem, and that leads to things like Hurricane Katrina and a whole lot of things. You get these wild gyrations that can't be controlled and that will get worse and worse over time as the ecosystem attempts to, you know, reestablish homeodynamics. And, you know, it's way beyond the point right now that we can do much about it. It's we're trying to hold on to it's just like anybody going into psychotherapy, you know, and I worked as a psychotherapist for a very long time. They come in and, you know, and they're engaging in this behavior that's making them completely unhappy and it's not working. And you say, well, you need to change this behavior. And they go, yeah, but can I keep the behavior and just fix this other stuff? And it just, you can't. The behavior, the underlying ideas, perspectives, the way we do stuff, they all have to be changed at an incredibly deep level. And so, you know, you might think we're just talking about some wild plant populations that are disappearing, but that goes so deep into what's happening, you just can't. I mean, it's such a fundamental problem.
Declaration of the Four Sacred Things. The Earth is a living, conscious being. In company with cultures of many different times and places.
In company with cultures of many different times and places, we name these things as sacred: air, fire, water, and earth. Whether we see them as the breath, energy, blood, and the body of the mother, or as the blessed gifts of a creator, or as symbols of the interconnected systems that sustain life, we know that nothing can live without them. To call these things sacred is to say that they have a value beyond their usefulness for human ends, that they themselves become the standards by which our acts, our economics, our laws, and our purposes must be judged. No one has the right to appropriate them or profit from them at the expense of others. Any government that fails to protect them forfeits its legitimacy. All people, all living things, are part of the earth life, and so are sacred. No one of us stands higher or lower than any other. Only justice can assure balance. Only ecological balance can sustain freedom. Only in freedom can that fifth sacred thing we call spirit flourish in its full diversity. To honor the sacred is to create conditions in which nourishment, sustenance, habitat, knowledge, freedom, and beauty can thrive. To honor the sacred is to make love possible. To this we dedicate our curiosity, our will, our courage, our silences,
our
and
silences,
our voices,
and our voices.
To this,
to
we,
this
dedicate
we dedicate our lives.
Lives.
Glistening brimstone, brought from the great rim of my native Etna and other stones of cauldron mountains, fixed stories of the earth. Glistening brimstone, brought from my great Etna, fixed stories of the earth. Tiny mirrors break the light to myriad points of subtle hue, in fireborn stone of yellow vapor. Fused to fine array and perfect order. What are we to make of you already made? Where are those heavens and where are those hells so openly hidden within you? Where are those heavens and where are those hells so openly hidden within you? Where are those heavens? Where are those hells? So openly hidden within you. Look not for now to fire mountains or distant galaxies. Let us see what is here at hand. I call and you appear in unexpected forms. Man and lion framed in fine folds. Old yellow stone. I call and you appear in unexpected forms, gathered from the scattered atoms of Earth's fury. The scatter points call us to attention without fail, but we must first stop for it to begin. The scatter points call us to attention without fail. But we must first stop. You seal the cleft from fiery breath of hot Sahara. You brought some comfort to those in valleys of the north. You sang your song anew in the old stone temple. You burned with Etna in the end. Alone upon that cauldron mountain, the ground around you heaved and shook. What drove you then to dance and fly into the thunder when earth shone brighter than heaven? And here again, a tale's untold, scenes unseen. For ages long, here again, the tales untold, scenes unseen, for ages long. Where are those heavens, and where are those hells, so openly hidden within you? Where are those heavens, where are those hells? Let us see what is here.
We We talk about the adjustment of contemporary industry, and we want to make this adaptation and that adaptation to the industry, the industrial, commercial, plundering process. And we are very reluctant to even think of this being inherently incompatible with the integral functioning of the various components of the Earth system. Because it's not simply a matter of modifying our energy use, recycling. It's not simply the trying to mitigate the pollution so that the system can go on. It's over with. It's over with the industrial plundering system. It's done for. The petroleum basis of the contemporary existence, it might last at most 50 years, probably 30 to 40 years. The major part of the petroleum will be gone, and that's the basis of our food supply, our clothing, our utensils, and plastic world, and all of this. It's over with. Our children and our young children will see the end of it. They will also see the end of population expansion.
Stone faces. This is the plain of lost skulls. How much blood must fallow before we have had enough? This is the wall of stone faces. This is the plain of dry skulls. How much slaughter does it take? Wretched clouds of infernal fury that burned all hope and poisoned the story. Careful now. Careful now. Be careful now. Because we have had enough. We've grown too accustomed. Stone faces. This is the plain of no spear, no arrow, no shield or saber close at hand. Only love. Blast of cannon barely muted. Now thunder of jet. Hiss, missile.
There's a fundamental law in the governance of Earth, in all of the expressions of life, that no one organism can overwhelm the community and survive. Each organism must come up against the constraints imposed on it as community. Earth is community. No one species in the whole process has evolved apart from the relationships by which it's bound in the local community in which it finds itself.